Support for NPR Newscast comes from State Farm. Get to a better state. 1-800-STATE-FARM or statefarm.com.
And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's topical currents. What's so funny, Bonnie?
Lorenzo.
That April Fool's business?
Yes.
Well, today we visit with New York Times culture reporter Dave Itzkoff. He's the author of Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. And Dave Itzkoff joins us from NPR New York. Welcome to you, Dave.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Great to have you. So I wanted to start with the Mad as Hell scene, but Joe didn't agree with me doing that because I thought there are a lot of people who may
not... Now we're putting our laundry out.
Well, because I thought there are many people who maybe don't know the movie. And then I thought so many of us do have that Mad as Hell theme, scene so firmly embedded in our minds, but it
well,
was made...
Well, go ahead and play it then.
Well, it was made in 1976, the year that Dave Itzkoff was born.
Right.
So, yeah. So how did you first connect with the film?
Well, you know, I've been kind of tracing the steps in my mind. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think what connected me to it was, a Mad Magazine parody, actually, that would have been published a few, months or years after the film came out, where one of the running jokes was about how dirty the language in the movie was, and they keep having to censor out all the dialogue with those little funny cartoon symbols of, hashtags
right.
and exclamation points and lightning bolts, and that just made me want to seek it out, at least as a kid. But as an adult, I had a much different experience where, about 3 years ago, the New York Public Library, which now owns the papers of Paddy Chayefsky, who is the screenwriter of Network, they invited me to come just take a look at some of the papers that had to do with Network. And those were things like drafts of the screenplay, but also, letters that Chayefsky wrote both before and after the movie came out. So things like a letter that he wrote to Paul Newman trying to persuade him to play the Howard Beale character. And then things like letters of apology that he wrote after the movie was released to Walter Cronkite and to John Chancellor, which really suggested a much deeper story about the film than had ever been told. And I mean, I always knew it was a movie that kind of, straddled the boundary between, motion pictures and television and sort of encompassed all the things about media that interest me. So that was the impetus to just kind of dive into it.
Well, we have audio of the cathartic scene.
And I just want to add.
And we've excised.
Yes, we've had to put the hashtags in. And so I've actually left the beginnings of the words and the ends of the words, so it's just the middle. I hope I did a good job, because this is public radio after all.
Of course.
So, Lorenzo?
Q. Howard.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman, because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. I want you to get up right now.
Get up. Stay with them. Go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Things have got to change.
How many stations does this go out?
You've got to get mad.
67. I know it goes to Louisville and Atlanta.
I'm not going to take this anymore. Then we'll figure out what to do about the depression and the inflation and the oil crisis. But first, get up out of your chairs, open the window, stick your head out and yell, and say, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Boy, I'm pumped.
Now, Dave, I want you to set the scene for us for that. One of the things you say is that by this time in the movie, we already know that he snapped and he was out of his mind. But I remember when I actually saw the movie clearly thinking that the speech was quite sane amid his apparent insanity.
Right. That's the duality of this moment that we, you know, it's fun and interesting to just sort of listen to it, you know, absent any of the context of the movie and just to hear the words, because there is so much truth to them and so much about it that's still relevant in 2014. I mean, you hear him talking about, you know, being afraid of the Russians. That was in 1976. And, you know, here we are 38 years later. It's right. Still valid. Right. But you're right that, you know, the framework of the movie is that, you know, here is a man, you know, a television news anchor for a last place TV network who has already been told he's going to lose his job and who has threatened on the air to commit suicide, you know, in a future broadcast. And, you know, that moment of, you know, sort of losing his cool on the air actually then turns him into a kind of populist figure, that it makes his show, you know, at least more sensational, and that gives it a temporary ratings boost. And then that kind of sets up a showdown between his news director, who's a very sensible man and doesn't want, you know, an insane person ranting and raving on the air, and this kind of new school up-and-coming programming executive, a female executive who just wants the show to succeed and the network to succeed at any cost and wants Beale to stay out there and say crazy things. And it all comes together in this moment of him, you know, telling his audience, you know, I want you to be angry. Please, you know, I'm telling you how to be angry, and here's what I want you to do.
Now, I want to talk about Panacheyevsky a lot, you know, because I realize that this book arose from an article you were researching about him.
Right.
So, but was he an angry, frustrated man to begin? I mean, is that who he was?
I think so. I mean, that's not his only identity. I mean, certainly, you know, people who know him and worked with him, you know, he died in 1981, only a few years after Network came out. And people have many different experiences with him. I mean, he was, you know, a very jocular person and you know, very, you know, had a great sense of humor, very witty, but also was somebody who was very deeply attuned to what was going on, you know, in his own sort of backyard, so to speak, in New York at a time when, you know, the city was really in dire straits, really had a lot of concerns for what was happening in the country and just worldwide. I mean, if there was anything, you know, to be afraid of or have anxiety about in 1976, Panacheyevsky was certainly frightened about it. And all the things that you hear, you know, Howard Beale kind of ticking off in his speech about, you know, depression and inflation and the Russians and guns in the street. I mean, these were all things that bothered Chayefsky to some extent. And he was also somebody who, despite having had this really kind of remarkable screenwriting career, that by the time he wins the Oscar for Network, that's his third Academy Award for screenwriting, was also somebody who had a lot of professional frustrations and had kind of meandered from, you know, a television career in the kind of golden age, the 1950s, to movies, to theater, then back to, you know, TV and film, and was never really satisfied in any particular medium, was always fighting for control of his own work and the right to, you know, present it exactly as he had written it, and always kind of let down by his experiences, always feeling that whatever message he might have had in a particular movie or play, it was not being totally received by his audience. So that was a constant source of frustration for him.
What do you think that Patty would think about Comedy Central and Jon Stewart and Colbert?
You know, it's interesting. I hope he would embrace people like Colbert and Stewart, who are really kind of advancing the joke of his movie, that these are people who are, you know, telling you, you know, the factual truth with a wink and a nod. I mean, they're both, they're sending up everything that's wrong with the news at the same time that they're delivering it. And, you know, that's, I think, what his movie was trying to do. At the same time, though, I think he would also be, you know, horrified and appalled by a lot of other contemporary broadcasters. I won't name any names, but people who are maybe playing the Howard Beale character much more literally and who are, you know, let's say the pure demagogues that, you know, his character suggests without any of the self-awareness or humor.
You wouldn't think of Glenn Beck.
I'm not naming any
names. He's not naming names. But let me ask you, after studying his papers as you have, did he write Network as a satire, or did he write it as what he thought was going to happen, a taste of things to come?
You know, it's a really fascinating process. And if you asked him on any given day of the week, you know, 3 days out of seven, he will tell you it was just a satire and a comedy. And the other 4 days, he might tell you, no, this was my literal prophecy of what was going to come true. But, I mean, it was, you know, it's funny. For people who still know Network, I think there's a kind of an urban myth that's gotten kind of associated with the movie that Chayefsky wrote it. Kind of as an act of revenge, either to, you know, get back at television, which had maybe abandoned him, or at specific people in the industry who maybe he felt had wronged him. And, you know, my experience from, you know, looking over his papers and drafts is that that's really not true, and that it was a much more organic evolution, that, you know, by the mid-70s, he'd had a couple of other things that came really close to getting made and didn't happen, and he's you know, flailing around a little bit just to find a new project, and he just sort of gets this idea to actually start visiting, you know, the news operations at like NBC and CBS, and he gets shown around by, you know, Walter Cronkite and John Chancellor, and he doesn't himself know whether he wants to write a movie that's a kind of, you know, a fictionalized day in the life of a network, or maybe something a little more satirical, and it evolves as he writes it. But of course, he, as a dramatist, he's just drawn to, you know, satirical events, and I mean, he already has a very deep concern about, you know, what would happen if you took a news anchor who is a trusted person and has access to, you know, millions and millions of people a night. You put that person out there and he says something that's not factual and maybe even insane. And what would happen to an audience? How would people receive that? And then what would happen within that network? How would all these events kind of spin out? So he starts with that kind of genesis. And, I mean, of course, he's drawn to a movie that is, you know, deeply satirical and you know, very, you know, concerned for, you know, how this medium is going to evolve and how our world is going to be changed because of media.
And it has. We're speaking with Dave Itzkov. He's a culture reporter at the New York Times, writes about film, television, theater, music, popular culture. And his latest book is Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Let's take a short break and we'll be back.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, 95% of the world's ATMs run on an operating system that Microsoft will no longer support. What might this mean for banks and an ATM user?
So you're looking at machines that will either have to be, you know, just basically taken to the dump or will have to be upgraded at great expense.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Join us for Here and Now starting at 2 p.m. Man of La Mancha is playing at the Pembroke Pines Theater of the Performing Arts from now through April 13th. You can join Don Quixote on his quest for the impossible dream and see things not as they are, but as they ought to be. Tickets available at pptopa.com or 954-437-4884. That is pptopa.com or 954-437-4884. South Motors Jazz at Pinecrest Gardens presents Grammy Award-nominated artist Ed Calle and his big band. Known for his extraordinary ability to play bebop, Latin, and contemporary jazz and pop, Kanye is hailed by Skip Spratt as an artist with a virtually flawless technique and outstanding control. You can join Ed in a tribute to great saxophone legends and a special tribute to George Gershwin, Saturday, April 5th. Tickets at pinecrestgardens.org.
And we return to today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and New York Times culture reporter Dave Itzkoff. We're talking about the great movie from 1976, Network, which won 4 Academy Awards. A posthumous best actor for Peter Finch, of course, who played Mr. Beale. Tell me, Dave Itzkoff, get into Faye Dunaway's character Diana.
Sure. So as we were talking about earlier, the sort of, you know, the two characters who kind of come to a collision in the film, one is the news director played by William Holden, and the other is, you know, a young programming executive named Diana Christensen, who is played by Faye Dunaway. And, you know, in the evolution of Chayefsky's screenplay for Network, at one point he had sort of two separate ideas that there would be this kind of, you know, young hotshot character, somebody who'd come from maybe a local news market and had a lot of success, you know, sort of making tabloid news, and then a kind of, you know, a love interest for this character, very kind of, you know, run-of-the-mill, you know, doting woman who would redeem this person with her love. And then at some point he gets this idea to kind of smash these characters together, and he's going to make the hotshot programming executive, he's going to make her a woman, and not only, you know, a woman, but a very hard charging woman in an all male environment, and somebody who is very used to fighting for what she wants and getting what she wants. And you know, it's certainly for the 1970s, I think a lot of people thought this was a very radical idea, something that was certainly not seen often in the workplace, and definitely not seen in broadcast television. And it sets up, you know, a very kind of tricky situation for Faye Dunaway herself, who, by the time she is cast in Network, her career has kind of risen and fallen a couple of times. I mean, she's done movies like Bonnie and Clyde and Chinatown, which both got her Oscar nominations. But she also has a kind of troubled track record in the business. I mean, she's known as an actress just for being, you know, very demanding, having lots of strong ideas, really wanting to be able to converse with her directors and have input into her roles. And certainly for the 1970s, that's kind of unheard of. And, you know, certainly a lot of male directors will not countenance this from their actresses. And now here she is playing this very kind of, you know, headstrong woman. And she certainly knows going into this role that it's going to shake people up and maybe even make her forever associated with that character. And it's a you know, an assignment that she very eagerly embraces.
We actually have an emailer, Andrew, who says, Faye Dunaway became an A-level movie star by the early 70s, I suppose. I've wondered, however, if another actress who never got roles to put her at that level might have been a better choice for Network. I'm thinking one of my personal favorites, Angie Dickinson. How do you think she would have done instead of Dunaway in Network?
I mean, it's hard to predict exactly how anybody else would have done in that role, because it's such an iconic performance now. Although, I mean, there certainly were, you know, Dunaway was always at the very, very top of Chayefsky's list, and the director Sidney Lumet wanted her, but they also considered everybody from, let's say, Candace Bergen to Natalie Wood. I think those would have been a little hard to imagine. I don't know if either of them, you know, I mean, you need somebody who is just, you know, rugged and relentless and will kind of tear into the role, and I think, I mean, that's what Dunaway did.
Ruthless.
Yeah, so perfectly. I mean, just, you know, if you recall the film, I mean, she's simultaneously having an affair with the character played by William Holden at the same time that she's threatening him, you know, I'm going to take over your news show. And the fact that she can be both his sort of romantic partner and professional rival at the same time, very hard to hold those two ideas in your head together. And you know, I think she pulls it off pretty uniquely.
We're speaking about the book Mad as Hell by Dave Itzkoff, And if you want to join in the conversation, and we're talking about the Movie Network, of course, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, and you can email radio@wlrn.org.
Dave, does network chai the audience more than it does the corporate and news types?
I don't know if it's more than, but certainly equal to. I think that that's a very perceptive thing. I think people sometimes, you know, we see so clearly how it's mocking corporate news and the creation of news that we sometimes miss that, you know, as a news viewing audience, this movie is also kind of satirizing us. Mm-hmm. If you think even back to, you know, that very eloquent Mad as Hell speech that you played at the beginning of the program, what follows from Howard Beale giving that speech is all the audience members, all the people watching him at home, actually going out to their windows and all shouting out as Beale directed them, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore. And even as they're doing that, we also see the William Holden character, you know, kind of looking out his window and watching everybody else doing this. And he's kind of shaking his head in disbelief that these people, whether or not they're angry, they're just kind of all doing this weird behavior because somebody on TV told them to. And we, as TV viewers, we really do behave that way. I thought even if you remember during this year's Academy Awards when Ellen DeGeneres took that very famous selfie photograph and then told everybody, retweet this on Twitter.
And they did.
Millions of people did without even thinking about it. And that's the power of television.
Let's talk about when the movie came out, because
remind
us how it was initially received, first by those in the news and the media, and then second by the public.
Sure. Well, two very different receptions there, because, you know, the news industry at large completely disowned it. And, I mean, it was sort of almost a strategy of MGM and United Artists, the studios that released Network, kind of inviting these news people in to see early screenings of the film, almost knowing that they were going to have very strong opinions, and that would sort of help them market the movie, that it would create controversy, and that in turn would create curiosity about the film. But, you know, because Chayefsky had been given so much access to, you know, the news operations at CBS and NBC and so on, and by people who didn't really know what kind of movie he was going to write, that when they did see the end result, a lot of them felt really burnt and really taken advantage of. And that's sort of what led to, you know, those apology letters that Chayefsky wrote that I told you about earlier, that
right.
These people were just so, you know, offended by the film and really in disbelief that, you know, even though the movie is not describing the world that they live in necessarily, they just had such a pride in their work and just this sort of ironclad belief that, you know, news would never allow this to happen to itself, that they were sort of disgusted by the film. But that was all very good for the sort of wider release of the film. That, you know, critical opinion was also pretty polarized. There were some very strong positive reviews, some very strong negative reviews. But commercially, the movie did very well, that it was made for a budget of about $4 million and in its initial release took in about, you know, $20 million, which is very successful. And, you know, multiply those by a factor of 10, you'd have, you know, roughly a contemporary $40 million making $200 million at the box office. That would be pretty good in 2014. And then, of course, it got nominated for and won a bunch of Oscars, which, of course, is, you know, for Hollywood, that's the ultimate validation.
I want to talk about the Oscars and that whole controversy with Peter Finch, but we need to take another break. If you want to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. We are speaking with the culture reporter at the New York Times, Dave Itzkoff, about his book, Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. We'll be right back.
Coral Gables Museum Gallery Night Live this Friday features Marking the Millennium, plus two new exhibit openings, live music, cash bar, and free admission. Details at coralgablesmuseum.org.
This is Ted Grossman for Night Train. Sunday, we'll listen to the music soundtrack from the Glenn Miller movie Orchestra Wise. Not the commercial recordings, but from the 20th Century Fox soundstage of April 7th, 1942. Sunday night, 8 p.m. on WLRN, WKWM, and WLRN.org.
The Miami Dance Festival kicks off its 2014 season with a shared performance by host company, Momentum Dance Company, and the PGK Dance Project from San Diego on April 5th at 8 p.m. at the Byron Carlisle Theater on Miami Beach. Details at MomentumDance.com.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. And we're speaking with New York Times culture reporter Dave Itzkoff about his book, Mad as Hell, which, of course, addresses the 1976 movie Network. Tell me, Dave, do you think that Network could be made in today's media and film climate?
I mean, I hate to be so cynical, but I don't think so. I mean, I think its spirit is still alive in you know, some contemporary movies, but the specific idea that it's talking about, and you know, what it's taking on, in the way that it does take direct aim at the media, it would be very hard now, I think, to, especially in a world where the movie studios and the TV networks are by and large all owned by the same corporate conglomerates. You know, it would be really hard to go to a movie studio now and say, you know, please give me tens of millions of dollars so I can tell you how stupid you are. I don't know that's a really viable proposition.
So, excuse me, but it's ironically because of the situations that are prophesized that the movie couldn't be made today.
Oh, exactly. I mean, one of the things the movie is warning about is this kind of, corporate synergy and the risk of, a big media outlet basically having to serve the needs of an even larger corporation. And that is exactly one of the very reasons why you couldn't really tell this story today, or nobody would let you do it that way. And also, it's just hard to imagine, you know, filmmakers and screenwriters with the kind of, you know, the passion and the energy that somebody like Paddy Chayefsky had. As you know, if people read the book, they'll see. I mean, he really fought so fiercely for his own ideas and to get to make his movies a certain way. And I don't know that, you know, there are very smart and thoughtful people still out there today. But I think we've just become accustomed to compromise and to a certain system under which movies have to get made, that, you know, if you encountered as many roadblocks as Chayefsky did, it's at a certain point we'd all give in. He was the one person who really, you know, charged at them head on and wasn't afraid to split his head open if that's what it took.
How about this idea in television that anger is shtick? It didn't start with Network. I remember Joe Pine even before Network,
sure,
that had that kind of attitude. And, of course, it continues on today of fake anger.
Right, right. Well, certainly, I mean, the line that's used in Network, or the way that Howard Beale describes his own job, is, you know, articulating the rage of you know, articulating the public rage. And that's, you know, I mean, certainly that's what's happening in the movie, that there are people who are watching who are just kind of angry and don't even seem to know exactly what they're angry about. And his, you know, what makes him so successful is that he's sort of giving them things to be angry about. He's just giving them ways to unleash their energy by being angry about things. Certainly there are no shortage of similar personalities like that today, who are very apt at, you know, finding an issue of the moment and getting people riled up about it and just kind of setting them loose on it. And, you know, with no really without even concern for the consequences, and then just moving on to whatever the next invented outrage of the day might be. And I think it's done. You know, as we were talking before, I mean, Beale is doing this basically out of insanity. The people doing it for real today are doing it with, I think, very considered calculation.
I'd like to ask you, we have a few more cuts, but right at this point with what you're talking about, do you think it would be better to play In a Lot of Trouble or The Money Speech by Ned Beatty
Oh, if you can play Ned Beatty's speech, that would be fantastic.
Okay, let's do that now.
If I can make a request.
Yes, okay, let's do that now. It's number three.
You have meddled with the primal forces of nature, Mr. Beale, and I won't have it. Is that clear? You think you merely stopped a business deal? That is not the case. The Arabs have taken billions of dollars out of this country, and now they must put it back. It is ebb and flow, tidal gravity. It is ecological balance. You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. Petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, Reichmarks, rims, rubles, pounds, and shekels. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet. That is the natural order of things today. That is the atomic and subatomic and galactic structure of things today. And you have meddled with the primal forces of nature. And you will atone. Am I getting through to you, Mr. Beale?
Just a great, great performance.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's pretty. Yeah, tell us about that. Set that for us.
Oh, certainly. So at this point in the movie, I mean, when Beale has sort of become, you know, really a full on prophet, spelled with a PH, he sort of halted in his tracks by the chairman of the board of the corporation that owns his network, a character named Arthur Jensen, and that's Ned Beatty, who we just heard. Who's basically telling Beale, here's how the world really works. And in contrast to Beale's mad as hell speech, which is, delivered by an insane person, this is a man who is just, coldly sane and really just spelling out for him, no, everything in contemporary life is business. And that dictates, how everything gets done. And what he's really telling Beale is, feel free to go on the air and rant and rave and say outlandish things. I'm okay with that. But the moment you do anything that could threaten my business interests, that's where I have to stop you and draw the line. And, I mean, think about all the kinds of ways that conversation is probably being replicated at, all kinds of broadcasting companies today. I mean, maybe in much more gentler tones than Ned Beatty delivers it, but that's a very real conversation that I'm sure is occurring.
Right.
Well, never hear.
And
of course,
there's so much visual too in that scene with the table that has about 50 seats at it. He's at
very
one end.
Very intimidating. Yeah.
Yes, and Peter Finch
that's
is
right.
Like a deer in the headlights, sitting there
right
at the other end.
Let's
go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was just going to, one quick detail if I can throw in. They wanted to originally film that scene at the boardroom of the New York Stock Exchange, and the Stock Exchange was very happy to comply up until the moment that they read the script and saw the lines, and they were like, no way, we're not doing this. So that scene is actually filmed at the, one of the big rooms at the main branch of the New York Public Library in New York, actually just a couple blocks from where I am speaking to you from.
Oh. That's a neat little fact.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. And we'll go to Gail. She's in Boca Raton. Hi.
Hi. I wondered if Dave might know whether the fact that Patty Chayefsky was blacklisted had anything to do with the script.
I'm not aware that he ever was blacklisted,
he was.
To be honest. He was somebody who very carefully avoided a lot of political controversy, particularly in the 50s and 60s, certainly was no fan of communism. And, I think wise enough to make sure that he stayed away even from, meetings or organizations, certainly was never on, any of the, the sort of fabled lists, that got circulated in that very dark era. I mean, he had a fairly continuous career from, from TV to film to theater and back. And, anytime he kind of exited one job, it was never because he wasn't permitted to work in any particular arena. It was only because of his own frustration, his own anger, and his feeling that if I can't get enough control in TV, well, surely the theater will let me have what I want. And if he couldn't get that from theater, he would go into film. He's not, he really did not ever align himself with any particular political cause or party. His politics are, I think, much more elusive than that, and I think that kept him out of a lot of trouble in, a very, dark and kind of shameful era of, entertainment history.
After Network, would you say that Marty was his next greatest achievement?
I mean, certainly in terms of works that that have endured, and both at the film with Ernest Borgnine that won Best Picture and won him his first Academy Award, and also I would encourage, if people can find it, the original TV version that was made in 1953, not with Borgnine but with Rod Steiger as Marty. It's presented in a much different way, much simpler. A little bit more raw, and Steiger's performance is not quite as loving and charming as Borgnine's was. It's almost a kind of a Brando-esque on the waterfront take on the character.
Where is that available, from Netflix or something?
Or YouTube?
I know that there is a Criterion Collection DVD release called The Golden Age of Television, and that has a lot of the great Philco Goodyear presentations, and some, I think, of the Playhouse 90 TV plays from that era. These were all things that were basically shown once, and in the 1950s, nobody was thinking about DVDs and home video, so they weren't preserved particularly well. But if you can find that DVD collection, they're excellent.
David in North Miami Beach asks if Network is the fictionalized opposite of Left of the Dial, about the short-lived Air America radio that helped Maddow and Franken.
I think you could definitely. It is an interesting mirror image of that, right? I mean, this is certainly, by the end of the movie, we're meant to think that this fictional UBS network is going to succeed wildly, in part by killing off Howard Beale, and by getting rid of its greatest truth teller. That's the path to success. I think the story that your listener is referencing there is one of the more truth you tell, the worse it is for business.
right.
Well, a la Keith Olbermann.
Well, Air America.
Right.
Okay, we need to take one more short break on topical currents. We are speaking with Dave Itzkov. He's the culture reporter at the New York Times, and his book is Mad as Hell. And we'll be right back.
Love is a complicated matter. There's pursuit, trust, practicality, infidelity, loyalty, wisdom, and even monotony involved. Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. On Wednesday's Topical Currents, we'll speak with the editor of the popular New York Times Modern Love column, Daniel Jones. He's been privy to tens of thousands of observations, musings, and wisdom about the meaning of love. He's compiled them in the book, Love Illuminated. That's Topical Currents, Wednesday at 1 o'clock.
April is National Poetry Month, and WLRN wants you to discover your inner poet. Think of a special place between the Palm Beaches and the Keys, take a picture of it, and write a poem. Include the phrase, "This is where," and submit it to WLRN.org by 6 p.m. on April 21st.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents Tuesday edition.
Yes.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dave Itzkov. He's the culture reporter at the New York Times, and his latest book is Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in the Movies. If Paddy Chayefsky I don't think we asked you this yet. If he were alive today in Sidney Lumet, what do you think they would think of the current landscape?
You know, I think Sidney Lumet, I mean, he's someone who maybe, you know, gets a little overshadowed in this tale because, you know, Chayefsky is such a, you know, dominant figure. And, you know, their collaboration together was really kind of amazing. And Lumet, of course, had his own, you know, wonderful trajectory as a filmmaker. But, you know, Lumet also, you know, I mean, kind of felt, you know, disowned by television, even though he'd had some very, you know, terrific experiences. He also, you know, made his bones in the golden age at the same time that Chayefsky was coming up, directing so much live TV. And then he broke through as a filmmaker, you know, making the original film version of 12 Angry Men. But by the time his film career had really taken off, you know, he sort of looked back at what had happened to TV and how rapidly it had evolved and gotten away from drama and was more about, you know, game shows and sitcoms, that he really felt like, you know, it had broken away from him. The line that he liked to use is, you know, I didn't leave TV, TV left me. Mm. So I imagine he would probably, on the one hand, he might not love a lot of what's happening in news, but I think if he were to look at, say, you know, the sort of typical Sunday night offerings on any of the cable TV channels, whether it's HBO or AMC, and, you know, shows like Mad Men or True Detective, I hope they would see those shows as kind of the direct continuation of the tradition that they created with the anthology drama shows.
Well, we do have one more clip that I'd like to get to because it's just so... what's the word? It's chilling is what it is. Huh. It's the last scene of the movie. If you'll set it up, we'll play it.
Sure. So this is the decision to actually go ahead and have Howard Beale killed. Is that
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So now at this point, Beale has become basically a runaway freight train, that he's just way too popular and saying things that, you know, his corporate masters are just really bothered by, and they can't think of a way to replace him. So the only decision they can really see is, well, let's kill him. And it's delivered in a very kind of straightforward manner.
What do we do about this Beale son of a bitch?
Suppose we'll have to kill him. I don't suppose you have any ideas on that, Diana.
Well, what would you fellas say to an assassination?
I think I can get the Mao Zedong people to kill Beale for us. It's one of their shows. In fact, it'll make a hell of a kickoff show for the season. We're facing heavy opposition on the other networks for Wednesday nights, and the Mao Zedong Hour could use a sensational opener. It could be done right on camera, in the studio. We ought to get a fantastic look-in audience with the assassination of Howard Beale as our opening show.
Well, if Beale dies, what would our continuing obligation to the Beale Corporation be? I know our contract with Beale contains a buyout clause triggered by his death or incapacity.
There must be a formula for the computation of the purchase price.
Offhand, I think it was based on a multiple of 1975 earnings with the base period in 1975. I think it was 50% of salary plus 25% of the first year's profit multiplied by the unexpired portion of the contract. I don't think the show has any substantial syndication value, would you say, Diana?
Syndication profits are minimal.
We're talking about a capital crime here. The network can't be implicated. I hope you don't have any hidden tape machines in this office, Frank.
Well, the issue is, shall we kill Howard Beale or not? I'd like to hear some more opinions on that.
But I don't see we have any option, Frank. Let's kill the son of a bitch.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's hear it. How do you feel?
We're out of town, and we're not going to be this anymore.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Network News Hour, starring the mad prophet of the airways, Howard Beale.
Yeah.
network news anchor man on the UBS Network News Show, known to millions as the Mad Prophet of the Airwaves, was shot to death tonight in a fusillade of automatic rifle fire just as he began this evening's broadcast. The extraordinary incident occurred in full view of his millions of viewers. The assassins were members of a terrorist group called the Ecumenical Liberation Army. Two of them were
apprehended. Colluding with a terrorist group. Tell us about, I mean, that was just so chilling, just the way they were talking about killing somebody.
Well, it's horrifying, you know what I mean, how sort of coldly and you know, easily they're talking about. You know, once they've sort of made the decision to kill him, then it's all about these corporate computations and contractual obligations. The death of a man is already a fait accompli. And then, you know, even in the moment when it occurs, if you know, people remember the visuals of that final scene, you're looking at a kind of grid of television sets, some of which are reporting on, you know, the death of Beale, and others are just showing, you know, TV commercials, the Life cereal commercial with Mikey. You know?
Right,
and
right.
It's sort of telling us that this is just going to be the way our media landscape is going to look from now on, that you're going to see these kinds of commonplace, horrific day-to-day events juxtaposed with, you know, cheerful breakfast cereal commercials. And yet, you know, just get used to a world like that. And I mean, it's kind of horrifying, and yet it's really not very far off the mark.
So you, I guess Sidney Lumet died shortly before you began work on your article about Patachevsky, but let's talk about some of the people you did interview who actually worked on the film. And I'd like to begin with Peter Finch's daughter.
Oh, sure. So, I mean, people may not know this about Peter Finch, but by the time he was even, you know, recruited for the making of Network, he was living a kind of life of semi-retirement in Jamaica. And, you know, he met a woman there who, you know, he later married and had a daughter by. And it became very controversial, of course, when Finch died and there was no one immediately on hand, you know, or it was unclear who was going to accept the Oscar on his behalf, because the Academy wasn't really fond of the idea of his wife accepting the award, and his wife was black. And I think a lot of home viewers did not know that until the moment that she came up to accept the award for him and saw that, you know, indeed she was a black woman. And, you know, the mother, that woman has since also passed away, but Finch's daughter is still alive and told me about, you know, living with him in Los Angeles at the time that he was in contention for the Oscar, and, you know, his getting up every day and looking in the mirror and brushing his teeth and practicing a kind of Oscar acceptance speech that, you know, he really thought he, you know, he knew that the role was going to do something for him and hopefully for his career, and really was preparing himself for the possibility of that moment that, you know, sadly he never lived to see.
And now we have another posthumous award winner.
That's right, Heath Ledger.
Right.
That was you know, the second instance of that ever happening. Finch was the first, and you know, a very you know, it's sort of a sad precedent. You know, what I mean, to have those kinds of circumstances. And, you know, I think the Academy was sort of you know, I mean, the closest they'd ever had to deal with that even prior, I think, was when you know, it was Spencer Tracy and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and in that case he didn't win, and they really didn't know, you know, for years what to do in those circumstances.
Didn't James sort of Dean die before Giant was released?
That's right, that's right. But also, I mean, again, in these cases, not, you know, no one had ever gone so far as to win. And, you know, now mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's chilling that they do have almost a kind of, you know, they have a precedent and they have a way of dealing with these situations that, you know, are now occurring more frequently.
Well, you have lots of those interviews. I wish we had more time. We just have about a minute. But you also spoke with some of today's broadcasters and film directors and writers like Aaron Sorkin, who was actually influenced by Chayefsky. And I just want to point that out. I mean, if you can tell us a short story about Adam Sorkin.
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, in Sorkin's case, I mean, you know, I mean, he was, you know, he's referenced Network many times in his TV shows, like Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. The Newsroom, which is on HBO now, is mm-hmm. very much a kind of a more humanist version of Network, I would say. And then when he won his Oscar for the screenwriting of The Social Network, the movie about the making of Facebook, he specifically cited Chayefsky in his acceptance speech, and you know, how proud he was to have also won an award for a film with the word network in its title?
Well, lots more questions, but we do have to go. We've been speaking with Dave Itzkoff. He's a culture reporter at the New York Times, and he writes about film, television, theater, music, and popular culture. And he's an author. His latest book is Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for the time and your interest.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction by Lorenzo Ponce de Leon. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. We also have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. Tomorrow's program is about everyone's enigma, love. What is it? What's the spark? And why is then monotony involved? We'll be with Daniel Jones, editor of the New York Times Modern Love column. And today's calendar for April 1st. On this day in 1777, 237 years ago, the first overseas fax message is sent during the Revolutionary War from the Continental Congress to Ben Franklin in Paris after the victorious battle of Saratoga. And on this day in 1876, 138 years ago, the first official National League baseball game is played. The Boston Braves and pitcher Al Spalding beat the New York Mets in a night game at the Polo Grounds. One more. On this day in 1956, 58 years ago, Elvis Presley turns down the role for the lead in the film The King and I. Of course, Yul Brynner wins Best Actor in the role. So we leave with a thought from Ben Franklin, who once wrote under the pen name of the widow Silence Dogwood, quote, "A country man between two lawyers is like a fish between two cats." Happy April Fool's Day. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Thanks for listening. Next, it's Here and Now from Where Else But NPR News.